Those who came after the Prophet became role model for them, and not the Prophet himself.
Right. Right.
For us, being a Muslim, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is the role model, and he is the one whom Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent. Uswatun hasana. لَقَدْ كَانَ لَكُمْ فِي رَسُولِ اللَّهِ أُسْوَةٌ حَسَنَةٌ. Indeed, certainly, in the Prophet ﷺ, there is a role model for you. So for us Muslims, the role model is Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, not anyone else, even the companions.
There's also an interesting fact to mention here. If you look at the history of Islam, the cradle of Islam, we never see jihad being used as an offensive term.
It was
an offensive war. It was purely a defensive war. And some might even say true Islam had never waged war as the first provocateur or as the offender. It's always been a defensive war.
That's true, that's true. Even in the Battle of Karbala, we see that Imam Hussein alayhi salam never allowed Abbas alayhi salam, his brother Abbas, to start the war. Every
right.
time, even on the 7th of Muharram, we have in the history, 7th of Muharram, Hazrat Abbas came to Imam Hussein that, shall we start? Because they have
permission.
Stopped us from the, yes,
exactly,
from the war,
yeah.
having a war. Imam said, no, we do not want to start war.
Right.
Let them start.
We are not the offenders.
We are not the offenders. On the 9th of Muharram, again, Hazrat Abbas wanted. So Imam said, like, take one knife from them. We do not want to become the offender.
Right.
So it was always a defensive. And this thing in the history of Imam Hussein shows us that he was the true follower of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Exactly.
Whereas if anyone else has done anything in the history or invaded a country, that is not the part of real Islam.
So we do not accept that in Islam as a concept at all. So the Iranians, you say, or history states that they were already predisposed to accepting Islam. And is that purely by the efforts of the letters that the Prophet sent, or did the Prophet also send propagators to preach about Islam?
Prophet has sent his companions, obviously, and the we can say there were like preachers at that time. For example, Salman al-Farsi, initially we have these narrations as well, like it's in the history, that when Iranians started to become Muslim, Salman has asked Prophet, can I teach them the translation of Surah al-Hamd? So they can read that in the prayers, daily prayers.
Right.
So Prophet exceptionally has allowed them at that time because they do not know Arabic language, because
right.
They do not know, like it's hard for them to memorize Surah al-Hamd.
Right.
Obviously, it's different language if you want
of
to
course.
Ask someone who never knows Arabic to ask them to memorize Surah al-Hamd and read it properly. So at that time, Prophet allowed them even. This is also mentioned in the history. So it shows us that even at the time of the Prophet, there were people who were Muslims, and they were the main reasons. Like obviously, they spread the words of Islam
right.
around the whole Persian territory.
Right. So Islam actually, as an exception, allowed newly converted Muslims to do the prayers in their own language, if
yes.
I'm understanding this correctly.
Yes. At that time, yes, Prophet did allow them.
As a
newly Muslim, so that
okay.
until they do not learn the Arabic language or Surah al-Hamd, or they do not memorize it, they can pray this way.
How beautiful, how beautiful. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your insightful knowledge, and we will just again circle back to this question, and just to conclude it, why the Iranians became Muslims? They were convinced by the ideology of Islam. How did it? Well, it has been a long historical process with a lot of preaching,
mm-hmm.
but at the end of the day, they chose the religion of Islam voluntarily.
Ahsan, yes.
Dear Sayyid, again, I thank you for your time. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in today. As always, it has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadli, and this has been your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Thank you for tuning in.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا له كل من كان محبا له يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A Yemeni human rights group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a report on casualties caused by 6 years of Saudi-led war on Yemen. The report says more than 44,000 civilians have been killed or injured since 2015 when Riyadh launched an aggression against Sana'a. Thousands of women and children are among the victims, according to the report.
We released a report on the casualties of the Yemen war during the past 2,400 days of the conflict. 44,221 civilians were killed or injured, targeted by airstrikes and cluster bombs. More than 4,000 children and 2,800 women are among the victims who lost their lives.
Also, hundreds have been left with permanent disabilities, the report says. Thousands of civilian facilities were also targeted by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes. Hospitals, schools, and power stations were bombed across Yemen, affecting lives of millions of Yemenis in a country already hit hard by poverty.
The Saudi-led coalition has deliberately targeted civilian facilities to kill civilians. It did not differentiate between civilian and military targets. The coalition has violated international laws that ban military attacks on civilian facilities.
However, infrastructure are not the only civilian targets hit by Saudi and coalition warplanes. According to the report, more than 500,000 homes have been destroyed during the war. As a result, millions of Yemenis have been displaced across the country.
The ongoing Saudi war and the blockade imposed on Yemen is killing more Yemenis as it has deprived millions of civilians, including children, of their basic needs such as food and medicine. However, the international community remains silent regardless of the situation in Yemen, which the United Nations describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Human rights organizations warn that the long-term Israeli blockade has led to deterioration of water crisis in Gaza, making the enclave's water undrinkable. The organizations also said the crisis has led to poisoning of the residents of the besieged enclave. The situation was exacerbated by an acute electricity crisis that hampered the operation of water wells and sewage treatment plants, leading about 80% of Gaza's untreated sewage to be discharged into the sea, while 20% seeps into underground water.
We suffer from shortage of water. Sometimes we are without water for weeks. Meanwhile, the available water is very salty, polluted, and unfit for daily uses, especially in the refugee camps. Palestinians here are forced to buy mineral water for drinking, but only a few of them can afford having it.
Israel's attacks on Gaza last May have doubled the crisis as the attacks pounded the enclave's already crumbling infrastructure. This presents a serious threat to the Gaza population's health, where recent data indicates that about a quarter of the diseases spread in Gaza are caused by water pollution, and a great number of deaths of young children and infants are linked to intestinal diseases related to polluted water.
Many children and elderly people are suffering from serious diseases due to the polluted water. Most of the families here go to hospitals on a weekly basis as they have kidney problems. We call on the International Human Rights Organization to support us.
The human rights groups also warn that the water crisis will lead to a catastrophe for the health system in the Gaza Strip and called on the international community to pressurize Israel in order to guarantee Gazans' right to water security.
There are three centers for treating water in Gaza which need fuel. We can provide only 35% of the required amount of drinking water. The residents of Gaza cannot drink the water. Our underground water is also polluted and unfit for drinking, and most of the time we are forced to buy water.
Israel has deprived Palestinians of benefiting from the natural resources of water, which has led to a serious water security crisis in the Gaza Strip. The shortage of water is threatening the lives of 2 million Palestinians and has doubled the burden on the health system in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Recent developments in Afghanistan have marginalized attention to coronavirus crisis in the country. In the meantime, officials and doctors at Kabul's Afghan Japan COVID-19 hospital say new money has been paid to the hospital, pushing it further towards a closure.
We have many problems as the cold season is approaching. We expect another wave of the virus in coming weeks. We ask our ex-donors to pay the salaries of the employees. We can't run the hospitals on our own. If their assistance is not resumed, the only COVID-19 hospital of Afghanistan will close.
Patients getting treatment in the hospital complain about insufficient medical supplies and care, urging the international bodies to save the hospital from closing and so the lives of Afghans.
My father has contracted the coronavirus. We are here for weeks. Everything seemed okay, but today we see that the hospital suffers from lack of oxygen and medicines. Meanwhile, the doctors have not been paid for months.
This comes as the U.S. insists on freezing nearly $9.5 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank and stopped shipment of cash to the nation. The U.S. says the assets will not be available to the Taliban, which remains on the Treasury Department's sanctions designation list. In addition to many humanitarian crises, the halt in global aid and the freezing of Afghanistan's assets have led to closure of most COVID-19 hospitals in the country. This comes amid warnings that Afghanistan could face COVID-19 outbreaks in the coming year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protecting press freedom. Supporters of the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange marching all the way to the British Royal Courts of Justice today ahead of an upcoming extradition hearing. The starting point, the BBC headquarters.
One of the main issues that we have with Assange is that his extradition, the case which is being heard next week, the whole basis of the case, the facts about the case, most of this never gets anywhere near the British media.
The U.S. government is attempting to extradite Assange under an old treaty with the U.K. for publishing damning documents of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and human rights violations elsewhere. His supporters say the charges are politically motivated.
It means basically that every journalist anywhere in the world has to be afraid of a possible extradition. Especially if he is reporting on national security issues, not just by the United States or other Western countries, but by any country.
Just last month, it was revealed that in 2017, as Assange began his fifth year holdup in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, the U.S. government plotted to kidnap or assassinate him on British soil. Still, the U.K. is carrying on with his trial.
It besmirches a reputation which at least the British establishment think they have got internationally. It's supposed to be a beacon of free speech. It's supposed to be a beacon of the free press. And while Julian Assange is in Belmarsh.
Since he was evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy 2 years ago, Assange has been languishing in a maximum security prison in southeast London. His next court hearing is set for October 27th and 28th. If extradited, he'll face 175 years in a U.S. prison.
It'll be a watershed moment in the most important press freedom case of the century. And these protesters say they're hoping that the U.K. government and justice system will do the right thing and put an end to what they describe as the show trial of Julian Assange. Saeed Pariza, London.
In a press conference held by the Sudanese pro-civilian rule factions, the Force of Freedom and Change factions, FFC, has categorically rejected any move to dissolve the government without consent of the factions and Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. Meanwhile, an unarmed group stormed the building of the Sudan news agency Suna and used physical and verbal violence to terrorize journalists and media professionals in an attempt to prevent the convening of the conference, which had been announced earlier by FFC.
We in the Forces of Freedom and Change affirm our continuous support for Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and his government, who were chosen by the FFC to lead the transition in Sudan, and we reaffirm our full support and coordination with him.
Sudan has been grappling with the biggest political crisis in its 2 years old transition. The military and civilian groups have been sharing power in troubled alliance since long-standing President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in 2019. Observers believe that the only way out for Sudan's current crisis through expanding base of participation and unification of revolutionary forces.
I assure that there is no way out of this crisis without expanding the base of participation and rearranging the internal conditions of the forces of the Sudanese revolution as the guarantor of any real transformation in the political scene.
On the other hand, protesters from the splinter FFC faction, the National Charter Alliance, have been holding a sit-in outside Khartoum's presidential palace for the seventh day, with soldiers around the site providing protection.
Time is running out for all government components without reaching a solution for the political crisis, while FCC rejects all the mediation and solution made by the military before handing over the power to the civilian next month. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
A new poll shows that 3 out of every 4 French people believes that their purchasing power has diminished due to rising inflation, and 90% of the nation is worried about it. The nation's economy minister departed from his Western peers by admitting that inflation will continue to rise until 2023 at the earliest. Combined with unemployment, which was entrenched even before the coronavirus recession, the admission seems to announce the beginning of dreaded stagflation.
La vie est chère et encore plus à Paris.
Life is expensive, especially in Paris, from real estate to basic shopping needs to even the price of a simple lunch. Our purchasing power keeps going down.
The government has just announced a cap on household gas prices until the end of 2022. Natural gas has soared to record highs across Europe. They also announced a one-time payment of 100 euros to those who earn less than 2,000 euros per month, which amounts to 60% of the population. However, many say the one-off payment is not nearly enough.
Ça devient compliqué, ça diminue fortement.
No, it's not enough at all. When somebody is only taking home 2,000 euros a month, 100 euros isn't nearly enough to make difference when it comes to energy costs. The government is not helping the middle class much at all.
The Yellow Vest protests, which initially kicked off 3 years ago due to rising fuel prices, just began what they called Season 2 last weekend. They are promising to continue marching. By a huge margin, purchasing power is the number one issue ahead of France's presidential election next year, just as it has been in all the elections since the great financial crisis began.
It's really fragile right now. The middle class just isn't seeing a fair relationship between their work and the amount they are paid.
Inflation is being reported seemingly worldwide, as the coronavirus lockdowns may have created a monetary monster. Many economists say the only solutions are controls on prices, as well as corporate profits, and higher wages, which have remained stagnant across the West for decades. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This was the first face-to-face meeting of EU leaders since the bloc's energy crisis really came to the fore. Millions of citizens simply don't have the money to pay for electricity and gas bills, which have skyrocketed since the start of the year.
We will intensify our outreach to the different suppliers, also to diversify the supply we do have, and we have to speed up the work on interconnections.
Experts say Iran, with its enormous oil and gas reserves, is an obvious option for the EU. Illegal US sanctions are hampering exports, but that will change if the Iran nuclear deal is revived.
The real game changer will be if Iran comes into international market with full force, increasing its oil exports, increasing its gas production.
It has been confirmed that during their summit on Thursday and Friday, EU leaders debated erecting barbed wire along the bloc's external border to manage the refugee crisis, made worse by the situation in Afghanistan. Ursula von der Leyen says the idea is out of the question. On the subject of COVID-19, the EU has failed to convince citizens in some countries to take the vaccine. For example, the virus is now out of control in Romania and Bulgaria.
Some difficulties that are related to the vaccination hesitancy, and it's why it's also important to cooperate, to coordinate, in order to make also progress on this challenge.
Some EU nations want funding cut to Poland over alleged rule of law breaches. Right-wing leaders, such as Hungary's Viktor Orban, are dead against the move, though.
There is no need to have any sanction. It's ridiculous.
Germany's Angela Merkel, who gave her last press conference at an EU leaders' summit before leaving office, says she's also opposed to legal action against Warsaw. Apart from not meeting the needs of citizens and in turn allowing populism to take hold, critics say another key reason the EU is facing rule of law issues is because those running the project have been too eager to expand at all costs to create a superstate, and in the process have allowed countries to join that do not share EU values. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A spectre is haunting America. The spectre of Striketober. Upwards of 100,000 workers across the U.S. are either currently on strike or potentially just weeks away from it, amid a historic wave of labor actions that's taken the country by storm. 35,000 nurses and healthcare workers have voted to authorize a strike against healthcare giant Kaiser Permanente. 60,000 Hollywood crew members seem headed for a strike amid widespread rank-and-file disapproval of a deal negotiated by union management. And thousands of workers elsewhere have already walked off.
Last week, 10,000 UAW members in warehouse and production jobs at John Deere started currently what is the biggest strike happening in the country. We have 2,000 TWA nurses in Buffalo and 1,400 Kellogg workers. They're also out on strike. About 1,000 mine workers in Alabama have been on strike at Warrior Met Coal since this past April.
These are just some of over a dozen labor actions brewing across the country. As executives have seen profits soar amid the COVID-19 pandemic, workers are insisting on their own piece of the pie. And with supply chain issues plaguing distribution and now hiring signs popping up left and right, they're wielding historic leverage to secure the raises and benefits they say management has been withholding for too long.
There is a tight labor market. Workers are fed up with being mistreated. We have, you know, the most pro-union president ever, potentially even more than FDR. We have a union leader at the Department of Labor who is heading the Department of Labor. Positive union sentiment in polls are the highest it's been in a very long time. Labor has a lot of leverage, and this critical moment is not going to last forever.
With the wind at their backs, many workers say it's time to press their advantage and lock in the wage increases and workplace improvements that have been steadily eroded by decades of neoliberal governance and attacks on organized labor. And with no real sense for just how long this window of opportunity will last, they say it's time to strike while the iron is hot. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
Six years have passed since Iran and several states, namely the US, China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany, put their signatures to a deal under which Tehran agreed to limit some of its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. But in 2018, the situation reached a deadlock when former US President Donald Trump backed out of the deal, Not only that, but he also brought back the sanctions despite Iran's display of full compliance. Tehran waited for 1 year before finally cutting back on some of its commitments under the deal. Later on, with the administration of Joe Biden sweeping into power and the White House's declared willingness to return to the negotiating table, Tehran and the remaining signatories went back to the Austrian capital with an agenda to revive the landmark accord. Initially, some progress was made, but long-running issues remain unresolved to this day. In the meantime, the U.S. continues to keep the sanctions in place as a tool of pressure against Iran. Now, with the possibility of a renewed push for the revival of the deal, Tehran says it will not settle for anything less than results that would safeguard the rights of its people.
Iran is a country of dialogue and negotiation. But a negotiation that guarantees the rights of Iranian people and forces all parties to return to their commitments.
Iran has been second to one point, but Washington was the party to violate the deal and should therefore be the party to take the first step by returning to full compliance. Tehran says it will start resuming its commitment only after the complete removal of all U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner. Action and not words. That's what Iran is demanding. It also says the European partners likewise need to put aside their empty promises and get back to action.
It was the inaction of the European states that emboldened Trump to withdraw from all agreements and violate the JCPOA and Resolution 2231. That happened because the European capitals all acted as only passive observers. We are expecting that all sides come to Vienna with the full understanding that there is no shying away from their commitments, which should be fully implemented under the accord.
Iran is seeking reassurances from the European signatories that such violations would never happen again. It says any renegotiation of the terms of the deal is out of question. The administration of President Ebrahim Raisi is reviewing the details of the previous six rounds of discussions held in Vienna. Now, with speculations on the possible resumption of talks in the coming days and Tehran's firm stance, one can only speculate about how the other parties will fare up.
Food experts in Britain have been advising shoppers to buy Christmas dinner months in advance or they might go without, leading to a surge in sales. Demand for turkey has gone up 400% in recent days, and even toy shops are warning their shelves might be empty soon.
With the pandemic easing, Brexit is back in the news, with shortages of food, fuel and labour taking their toll. And this is bad news for the Conservatives, who promised to get Brexit done.
Under pressure, the government has now been forced to relax immigration rules and start issuing emergency six-month visas for thousands of butchers, poultry workers and HGV drivers to save Christmas and prevent 100,000 animals from being culled. Nonetheless, Prime Minister Boris Johnson insists there is no supply chain crisis, calling the current situation a symptom of an economy in revival.
I hate to be rude about politicians, but I have to say the Prime Minister in this case does appear to be somewhat deluded. Of course, the United Kingdom economy does have some serious supply chain issues. Mind you, so does much of the rest of the world. You only have to look at the issues relating to shipping and such like. Britain has made itself in a more difficult position by adding the phenomenon that is Brexit, which has had added further complications and costs and reduction in the workforce coming from the largest trading bloc in the world, coming into the United Kingdom, and the UK economy is suffering because of it.
For decades, EU nationals have done labour-intensive work on British farms. Labour farmers say British workers just won't do. And the fact is it will take years to train enough Brits to drive heavy goods vehicles. So it might not just be a winter of discontent lying ahead for Britain, but years of adjustment. Bianca Rahimi, London.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Armed drones have become a staple of modern American warfare, placing operators at a historically unprecedented remove from danger. At the same time, they have exposed those targeted, whether combatants or civilians, to a form of violence that they can neither defend themselves against nor surrender to. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Murtaza Hussein, journalist. This article is published under the heading Psychological Tools and Moral Hazards of Drone Warfare. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. On what would be the last day of his life, Zimari Ahmadi, an employee of a U.S.-based NGO, was being watched by a remote crew piloting a Predator drone above the skies of Kabul, Afghanistan. As Ahmadi went about his work running a series of errands across the city, the drone operators, though they did not know his identity, were making plans to kill him. A series of innocuous actions like Ahmadi loading water containers into his car were interpreted in the minds of the operators watching as sinister preparations for a suicide bomb attack. After surveilling Ahmadi for several hours, the drone operators issued a death sentence, firing a hellfire missile at his car as he drove up to his home just as three children were rushing out to greet him. A total of 10 people, all civilians, were killed in the attack that the U.S. military had initially insisted had targeted a terrorist working with the Daesh. The deaths of Ahmadi and his family members were unique in the level of public attention they received. It was sadly unremarkable, though, in the context of the larger U.S. drone war that has been waged over the past 20 years. Armed drones have become a staple of modern American warfare, placing operators at a historically unprecedented remove from danger. At the same time, they have exposed those targeted, whether combatants or civilians, to a form of violence that they can neither defend themselves against nor surrender to. Freed from the traditional reciprocity of war in which both sides put their lives on the line, drone operators have become more like judicial executioners, putting people on trial on the other side of the planet without due process and meting out death sentences by remote control. The U.S. pioneered this style of warfare but is no longer alone in using what is technically called unmanned aerial vehicles or UAVs. Other countries, including U.S. rivals, are ramping up their own drone programs, signaling that this style of killing at great distance is likely to become a defining feature of war in the 21st century. Other drone operators describe experiencing physiological distress during their missions, as well as brief bursts of adrenaline following successful shots that supported friendly ground forces engaged in active combat. When they were asked to describe their worst day on the job, many of their responses dealt with what drone crews saw in the aftermath of certain strikes. One sensor operator on a drone described their worst day to Phelps this way: watching the son of the person I just obliterated with a Hellfire missile pick up the pieces of his father. It wasn't the act of killing I focused on. It was watching the boy's face and interactions with the rest of his family that continue to haunt me, unquote. In countries like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, the U.S. has carried out thousands of strikes in the absence of a meaningful U.S. ground presence. The people being killed on the ground in these strikes usually do not and indeed cannot pose any conceivable threat to Americans. Rennie argues, with reference to philosophical traditions like just war theory, that this makes even many purportedly legitimate drone targets, particularly the low-level rural foreign fighters who bear the brunt of drone program, little different from civilians. The concept of war as a legal and morally regulated activity was historically built on an assumption of mutual risk and danger among those taking part. That dynamic simply no longer exists when one side is fighting only with robots from the other side of the planet. While prior technological advances may have reduced the structural threat between combatants, drone warfare is the first time that one side has made themselves absolutely immune to violence. Rerik writes, UAV-exclusive violence marks a fundamental shift in the nature of hostilities from an adversarial contention to something more closely approximating judicial sanction. One outcome of this shift has been dehumanization of those targeted by the United States. What emerges in place of war as a situation of mutual risk is simply an unending series of executions carried out from the skies. The task of the people carrying out many strikes is less about overcoming an enemy in battle than issuing moral judgments and death sentences against individuals who pose no conceivable threat to the U.S., and whose customs, circumstances, and even identities are often unknown to them. To use a chilling metaphor, Rennick argues that killing through drone strikes outside of active combat situations is less like war, as traditionally defined, and more like a creative process of disinfection. In cases where drones are targeting high-level terrorists who are directly planning attacks against the U.S. or where they're supporting friendly ground forces in combat, the strikes are more justifiable according to traditional moral schema. These are not often the circumstances of drone strikes. Thousands of strikes have taken place outside of active combat zones over the years, or have targeted low-level fighters or even unarmed individuals who posed no direct threat to U.S. forces or even civilians. An investigative report recently published by the military-focused news site Connecting Vets, including leaked footage of many strikes, outlined the extent to which U.S. military commanders became obsessed with killing low-level suspected Taliban members in Helmand province, Afghanistan, during a 2019 drone campaign. After initially trying to cover up the killings of Zimari Ahmadi and his family in Kabul, the Pentagon subsequently backtracked, following a stream of news reports disproving their narrative about killing ISIS terrorists. Though it was forced to admit responsibility, the military has said that no disciplinary action would be taken against anyone involved in the attack that took the lives of 10 members of an innocent family. If drone warfare, whether autonomous or not, is to have any moral component at all, it must include some accountability for the innocent people regularly killed in strikes like the one that ended the life of Zimari Ahmadi. Periodic apologies aside, moral responsibility toward the tens of thousands killed, maimed, or deprived of their loved ones over the past 20 years has been in short evidence. Amal Ahmadi, Zimari's brother, told reporters in the aftermath of the drone strike, "That is not enough for us to say sorry. The United States of America can see from everywhere. They can see that there were innocent children near the car and in the car. Whoever did this should be punished. It is not right."
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام رب مستقبل يوما ليس بمستدبره ومغبوط في أول ليلة قامت بواكيه في آخره.
Imam Ali said, many a man faces a day after which he finds no day, and many a man is in an enviable position in the earlier part of the night, but is wept over by bewailing women in its later part. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, when talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali, we find that he was truly a master when it comes to eloquent speaking and eloquent writing. He was truly an amazing individual when it comes to eloquence, or as is known in Arabic, in balagha and fasaha. And so we find in sermon number 203 in Nahjul Balagha, this compilation of the sermons and letters and short statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that in this sermon 203, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, do not tear away your curtain before Allah, in front of Allah, who is aware of your secrets. Take away from this world your hearts before your bodies go out of it, because herein you have been put on trial and you have been created for the other world. So, dear friends, there should be this curtain of humility, of submissiveness, of humbleness, this curtain of honor and reverence that we must have before and in front of and in the presence of God, in the presence of Allah. And where does this curtain of humbleness and submissiveness and humility and tawazu, as we say, this humbleness, this piety, this submissiveness in the presence of Allah? Well, we realize that He is aware of all of our secrets. So do not tear this curtain of reverence and honor and submissiveness and humility and humbleness in front and in the presence of Allah. And then Imam Ali continues and he says, take away from this world your hearts. Again, when we're talking about taqwa, we're talking about piety, God consciousness, God awareness. One of the integral and critical things that must be done is to detach our hearts from this world, meaning we shouldn't fall in love with this world, we shouldn't be attached to this world. This world, materialistic wealth and property and belongings and family members should not be the main priority and the main goal and the main love in our hearts and souls. For the main goal and the main priority and the love, the primary love, the pure and ultimate love, which should be in our hearts and our souls, is the love for Allah. And when is the time frame in order for us to be able to implement these things and inculcate these things in ourselves? Well, Imam Ali says, before your bodies go out of this world, meaning before we die, At the time of death, the doors are closed. The trial is in this life, so make sure you succeed in this trial. And remember that you have been created for the other world, for the Akhirah, for the life that is to come. A profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالم على يدي يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger." And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In this program I would like to talk about Amir al-Mu'mineen, not that much from the historical point of view, but I would like to share with you some of his words about himself in Nahj al-Balagha. Ali, in the words of Ali. When we talk about the Fazail of Ali, one of the Sunni historians makes a comment. He says, if you look at all the books of hadith among Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah, all of them talk about the Fazail of the Khulafa and the prominent Sahaba of Rasul. But he says it's amazing. When you look at the number of ahadith which have come in the Sunni books about Ali, the number of ahadith from Rasulullah about Ali are more than the ahadith from Rasul that they have in their books for others. And then he makes a comment. He says, this is in spite of the fact that the enemies always tried to hide his virtues and the friends were afraid to express their feelings about Ali. So enemies were concealing it because they didn't like him. His friends were concealing his, his virtues and his qualities because they were afraid of being killed. Even then, the number of ahadith which have survived in the books of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah about Ali supersede the numbers that they have for other Sahaba and Khulafa. And this itself is a miracle and manifestation of the ayat of Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, they try to blow off the light of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by their, mouth, but they do not know that Allah has decided to protect His Noor even if they dislike it.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.